You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending October 17th. I'm Joe Elia. Admitting Diagnosis captures the week's essential medical news and wrestles it into a small audio presentation. Then we give you an interview. This week, we bring you an interview recorded earlier this year with John Douglas of the Centers for Disease Control about sexually transmitted diseases in young women. Next week, we'll be talking about the consequences of midlife smoking. If you'd like to leave a comment or a suggestion for a future podcast, call 617-440-4374. Links for everything are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. All right, here are the week's medical headlines. Aspirin and antioxidants don't offer diabetics primary prophylaxis against cardiovascular disease. B vitamins don't slow cognitive decline in Alzheimer's. However, vitamin D intake in children and adolescents should be doubled. And midlife smoking ruins later life living. And now for the details. Published guidelines suggest giving aspirin to diabetics to prevent first episodes of major cardiovascular disease. But a trial in the current BMJ shows no effect from either aspirin or antioxidants. Some 1,300 adults with type 1 or type 2 diabetes and asymptomatic peripheral arterial disease were randomized to receive aspirin, antioxidants, both, or placebo. After 7 years, the mortality rates from stroke or coronary disease and the rates of above-ankle amputation were statistically similar among all the groups. An editorialist reminds us that aspirin is not a benign drug and that it should be reserved for secondary prophylaxis in people who've already had a major cardiovascular event. Next, B vitamins, although they may lower homocysteine levels, don't slow cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease. As reported in this week's JAMA, some 400 adults with mild to moderate disease were randomized to either high-dose B vitamin supplements or placebo. During the 18 months of follow-up, although homocysteine levels declined significantly among patients on B vitamins, their rate of cognitive decline did not differ from those on placebo. Plus, those receiving vitamins were more likely to show symptoms of depression. Next, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended doubling the intake of vitamin D among children and adolescents. The recommendation is an update of their guideline from 2003, which now says that just about everyone, starting in the first few days of life, should receive daily supplements of 400 international units of vitamin D. There are two exceptions. First, those infants drinking at least a quart of vitamin D fortified formula daily don't need the supplements. And second, some children may need more. For instance, those on anticonvulsants or with darker skin and low sunlight exposure. Full guidelines are available free online. Finally this week, smoking in midlife leads to a shorter, sicker, later life, according to a study undertaken in Finland and published this week in the Archives of Internal Medicine. Smoking's effects were dose-dependent, and those who smoked a pack a day or more when followed up 25 years later lived an average 10 years less than never smokers. It's not a surprising finding, but one that might help people still smoking in their middle years to quit. That's the week's news. As I said earlier, our interview was conducted in March, and it's about sexually transmitted disease in young women.
Last month in Chicago, the Centers for Disease Control convened its biennial National STD Prevention Conference. Among the presentations was an analysis of data on almost 850 young women, teenagers between 14 and 19. The data were from the 2003-2004 NHANES survey on health and nutrition. What the data showed was, to quote one of the analysts, alarming. A quarter of the adolescents had at least one of the four most common sexually transmitted diseases: human papillomavirus, chlamydia, herpes simplex virus, and trichomoniasis. The rate among African Americans was even higher. Almost half were infected. We've asked Dr. John Douglas, who directs the CDC's Division of STD Prevention, to talk with us, and with Dr. Howard Bachner, a Boston University pediatrician who also writes for Journal Watch General Medicine and Journal Watch Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hi, John. So I'm a general pediatrician. I read the news reports in Journal Watch, the New York Times, and Joe gave me some information about it. What do you think are the most important points for a primary care doc?
You know, I think the key message out of these findings are that these four common STDs are, I think, more common when one considers them cumulatively than anybody had really realized before. I want to emphasize that all four infections, as you well know and as your listeners will know, are generally asymptomatic. People infected with them don't realize they have them. And while we call them STDs, these are infections, in many cases, that don't produce complications. So while these findings are clearly concerning, it's really important not to go overboard and create a notion that there are 25% of these young women are going to get sick with something. But I think the implication is that we've got a lot of missed prevention opportunities going on. 25% of this population representative sample had one or another of these STDs. And it really points to a number of missed prevention opportunities. For the office-based physician, probably the two most important are engaging your young, potentially sexually active adolescent females in discussions about a reproductive health and sexuality. This is often a conversation that's difficult to have because it's sensitive. It's difficult to have because office time is often limited. But without getting that conversation going, there are lots of opportunities for prevention that are missed. The second is to be aware of the things that can happen in an office-based setting to enhance STD prevention besides the conversation. One is annual chlamydia testing, which has been recommended for over a decade for young sexually active women, and for which we have national data that tell us that maybe only about 40% of women who need to get this are receiving it. This is one of our mainstays to prevent the complications of chlamydia, such as pelvic inflammatory disease and infertility. The other office-based lesson is the reminder that we don't have vaccines for all these diseases or infections, but we certainly do for the most common of these, human papillomavirus. And for a year and a half now, we've had an excellent vaccine that protects against four very common types, two of the types that are most commonly associated with cancer, and two of the types that are most commonly associated with genital warts. So to sum up, big prevention opportunities within office-based settings if practitioners are aware that these infections are so prevalent.
Well, let's just start with chlamydia. So I know about the annual screening recommendations and generally poor performance in the U.S. How do you think a primary care physician should screen? So I have three questions. How should they screen? What screening test should they use? How long will it take them? Because practitioners are busy. And who's paying for it?
Well, let me be sure I've got the three questions. How should they screen? How long will it take?
Correct. And who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, okay. Well, let's handle the easier ones first. The how should you screen? There are tests that can sample now three different types of specimens in young women. The traditional specimen has been the cervical swab. This requires a pelvic examination and is increasingly being replaced by the use of one of the other two less invasive approaches, which is urine-based testing and vaginal swab testing. Data indicate that these three approaches all have roughly equal sensitivity and specificity, and if you're not doing a pelvic exam anyway, the urine-based test is probably the most convenient. If you are doing one of these two less intrusive tests, then the time it takes is literally the time it takes to open a vial if you're doing a vaginal swab, take the swab, label it, and get it in the right place for processing. Urine takes a little longer because someone needs to use a restroom facility to produce a urine sample, but not any longer than it takes to produce any other sort of urine-based diagnostic test. The real complication is who pays for it. And, chlamydia is like every other preventive service delivered in the U.S. healthcare system except for vaccines. For vaccines, we've got a reasonably good entitlement program, really, which is what our National Vaccines for Children program is, which is if you're an underinsured adolescent, you can receive a recommended vaccine through federal resources. That's not true for chlamydia testing. It depends on if you have insurance will cover chlamydia testing in most circumstances. If you don't have insurance, it's much more of a patchwork. There are family planning clinics in most locales and STD clinics in most locales that will offer chlamydia testing for either very low prices or even free prices. Adolescent medicine clinics will also offer chlamydia testing on reasonable cost bases as well. But as you well know and as your listeners well know, this is extraordinarily variable across the landscape of healthcare delivery in the U.S.
Thanks. Sticking with chlamydia, so there was a interesting debate in the BMJ a couple months ago about talking about chlamydia screening as being largely a failed policy around the world, both with screening and then follow-up. So obviously you screen, it's positive, and then you have to get the patient back for treatment. And then in the different papers that came out of the conference, one of the more creative approaches was this expectant partner therapy. So first, if you could touch on what that actually is. And then secondly, we've really been successful in part because of CDC efforts in reducing inappropriate antibiotic use over the last decade, the so-called judicious use of antibiotic campaign. And it, to me, as a practitioner, it seems like the expectant therapy campaign actually runs contrary or in conflict to the judicious use campaign. So if you could talk about what the expectant partner therapy campaign is and how do you reconcile that with the judicious use of antibiotics.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me first clarify, because you alluded to the BMJ article that described chlamydia as a policy that's not working. And that's a complicated story. Let me point out that the major rationale for chlamydia testing is, in fact, not primary prevention, which is reducing chlamydia in the population. That would be a tremendous extra benefit if that happened. But it's mainly targeted at secondary prevention. We don't recommend currently screening in young men. We recommend screening in young women because of observations that if we can detect infection at an early stage, we can prevent sequelae. So important to realize that the fact that we don't have national data that indicate that prevalence is dropping doesn't mean that the practice is not useful. It is useful for preventing PID. Now, you refer to EPT. EPT, we generally mean expedited partner therapy, and by that we're talking about the administration of either delivery of antibiotics from the infected patient to her partner or his partner, because it can work both ways. Or in some cases, this can be done through the delivery of a prescription that the partner then takes to a pharmacy. Is this injudicious antibiotic use? Well, you know, the data indicate that anywhere between 20 and 40% of partners who are named partners are going to be infected or can be detected if they're tested to have infection. That's a pretty high proportion, and in most circumstances, one has fairly simple, straightforward therapy. That's a reasonable enough basis for making an empiric decision to go ahead and treat. And we've been recommending partner treatment of exposed individuals to a curable infection such as chlamydia for decades now. And so what's really different about the EPT is not treating people who aren't confirmed to have infection. Rather, it's using different modalities to reach partners. National data about how many partners are effectively treated with in situations where chlamydia is involved are not very complete. But we think that in the most, for the most part, it's not any better than about 50 or 60%. And a number of the modeling studies that we're now conducting that are looking at the question of chlamydia prevalence in the population tell us that the two key parameters for us to be able to reduce prevalence are going to be better screening, but also better partner services. And so what this is really trying to do is recognize that public health departments are never going to have the capacity to go out and do shoe leather contacting of partners, i.e. provider notification. And providers clearly don't have the time to do that as well. And rather than using what's ended up being sort of the fallback position of simply saying, look, your partner needs to be treated, be sure that he or she gets in, which is only successful in maybe 50% of cases, this really represents a promising adjunct that has been documented to reduce rates of reinfection in several studies now for both chlamydia and gonorrhea, I would point out. And we think it's got a lot of promise where it's administratively legal to enhance partner services.
John, let me ask you this. As a clinician in that case, it sounds like what you're doing is you're writing two scripts, one for the patient and one for the partner. Is that how it works?
It works different ways, Joe, in different places, because there are still a number of jurisdictions in which the legality of this is not clear. We're now working with STD control programs in each of the 50 states to define the permissibility of this process and then to define the legality. But in essence, in those states where it is legal, what you've just described is what happens. I'm either giving my patient two prescriptions, one for her and one for her partner, or if she's got several partners that she's willing to try to reach, multiple prescriptions for each of the partners. In some settings, especially public clinics in places where this process has been underway for a while, where medication is administered directly, medication is, in fact, sent with a partner as opposed to a prescription.
John, just staying with chlamydia, two other related questions. So it was interesting reading in the material, there seems to be some really creative approaches to enhancing screening. So some are office-based and some are more public health-oriented. So I know you have a really good view of what goes on in the U.S. So could if you could talk about creative approaches both sort of in the public health sector versus in an office-based practice, and in addition, particularly around office-based practice, if you could talk about whether health information technology, the electronic medical record, other ways has been helpful in enhancing screening.
Well, we are exploring a number of approaches through work we've done, as well as supporting and collating the work that others have done. And as you put it, there are public sector, public health approaches, as well as private health approaches or private practitioner approaches. I want to emphasize that the notion that STDs are largely a public sector or an underserved population who seek care in public clinics phenomenon is really a major misimpression. We look at the sources of reported STDs each year, and we're up to now 80% of national chlamydia cases being reported out of sources other than STD clinics. So it's really clear that if we're going to get on top of the national chlamydia problem, better diagnostic testing and treatment in non-public clinic settings is really critical. Some of the new approaches in public clinic settings have indicated, for example, that women coming in for emergency contraception, which a number of certainly family planning clinics have been offering, and a number of STD clinics, as well as emergency rooms, have begun to offer this as well, can present a really important opportunity for chlamydia screening. The prevalence in several clinics that reported at our national meeting was as high or higher than other women coming in for services. So a woman who's presented with a fear of insemination based on an unprotected sexual exposure is really a prime candidate for considering chlamydia testing. Another important public domain opportunity, although it's one that's fraught with the same kind of financial issues we've already discussed, is screening in correctional settings. The highest prevalences of chlamydia that we see for any venue come out of youth detention centers and young women in jails. And we've got another number of promising situations where correctional-based screening has been able to be ramped up with associated decreases in chlamydia prevalence as well as PID. And I would say that of all the public sector opportunities that are out there, corrections may be it. We have the dubious distinction of incarcerating more people in a higher proportion of our population than any country in the world. And while most of the people we incarcerate are men, we incarcerate a substantial number of women as well. And these often come, again, from situations where there are really high prevalences. So really important opportunities there. You ask about medical informatics, and I frankly think that one of the biggest opportunities we've got is to try to harness the power of that to serve as prompts to physicians that their client is in need of a recommended prevention service, such as an annual chlamydia test. There's some places where such prompts are being used, both to elicit risk history as well as to indicate that someone may be at risk, that have at least anecdotally been very promising. We also think that a major untapped area of promise is better public education. That was one of the reasons that we thought this information about the high prevalence of these infections in adolescent women or females was so important to get out, because we think that consumer demand, consumer awareness of what is needed, can really help inform and serve as reminders and prompts and settings. It can certainly serve as reminders within care settings if we can appropriately educate young women as to what they ought to be asking for and expecting. There's a huge misperception now, for example, that when you see a doctor and you're having your genital area examined, you're probably getting tested for everything that's recommended, right? Well, not necessarily, and lots of confusion about what's a pap smear anyway, what happens when I get a pap smear. So we think that the better understanding of what it is I need every year and clarifying whether I'm getting it can be very useful. We think that can also help promote visits to physicians. Some of the missed opportunities for screening aren't simply because people are going to physicians who are not carrying out screening activities, but because they're not seeking care at all. Now, a lot of that's obviously related to lack of insurance and lack of finances for seeking care, but we think that a better understanding of the benefits of seeking care may prompt some of that as well.
Thanks. Okay, I want to turn to a couple questions about HPV vaccine. So when I first heard it was coming out, my initial response is, ugh, not more vaccines for kids. Sorry. But it's an extraordinary story. Its potential to save lives is remarkable. So a couple questions. First, could you just go over the indications? Because I know the age of vaccination is critical because it really needs to come before sexually active women acquire HPV disease. So if you could talk about the indications. And if you could also talk about whether or not we've run into any problems with the vaccine since it's been approved. Funny things happen after vaccines get introduced. And then finally, is it competing at all with some of the other adolescent vaccines? And then I'll have a follow-up question about adolescent vaccination
okay,
in general.
Okay. Well, it clearly for the provider seeing adolescents represents another prevention issue to keep on an already very crowded agenda. So I appreciate your point about, oh, no, another vaccine. But you're right. It really is an incredible story. This is only the second sexually transmitted infection for which we have a vaccine. People often forget that hepatitis B, which has been a major success story, which can be transmitted lots of ways, but is currently predominantly transmitted by sex, is in fact such a preventable infection. You're dead on correct. You've got to get the vaccine into young females before they begin having sex. The median age of onset of sex in the U.S. right now is 16 years old. So by the time you're 16, half of the young women have had sex, half have not yet had sex. That's what's led to the recommendation that the vaccine be administered routinely to 11 to 12-year-old females. A very small minority of those could have become sexually active, although we think that's early enough that it's below the point that's very significant at all. Reassuringly, the vaccine is highly immunogenic in this age group. It produces even higher antibody levels than it does in adolescents and in older women. So we believe we've got an added edge of immunologic value by giving it to women of that age. I would point out that the duration of immunity is an evolving story. There are follow-up data now with the quadrivalent vaccine that go out to five and a half years, and at least at this point in time, there doesn't appear to be waning immunity. But as with any vaccine that's given, or really even a live vaccine, but certainly with killed vaccines or non-live vaccines such as this one, you have to be at least alert to the possibility of the need for boosters. That's being tracked on, no indication that it's needed at this point, but may become an issue at some point. Because a large proportion of women in their teens and even early 20s have not yet been sexually active or have not yet been exposed to all of the types in the vaccine, there is also a catch-up vaccination program recommended for 13 to 26-year-old females. So in essence, really any female at this point in time between the ages of 11 and 26 who's not received the three doses of the vaccine is recommended to receive it.
Sorry to interrupt, but just a point that it would be important for me or I think other people. Is that regardless of their HPV status?
It is regardless of their HPV status, given commercially available ability to discriminate types. The only test that's commercially available at this point, the hybrid capture test, will tell the physician if the client has one of 13 different high-risk types, but it won't tell you whether it's type 16 or 18. The large studies that were done in the pre-licensure phase indicated that a very small minority of sexually active women, less than 5%, had previously been infected with one of the four types. So having a positive HPV test or having an abnormal pap smear, which is another question that comes up, is not an indication that the person has no benefit from the vaccine. Now, I mean, let's be candid. The 25-year-old who's had several abnormal pap smears and has had a positive HPV test has, in all likelihood, had more exposure than the 11-year-old. And so the marginal cost-benefit or cost-effectiveness of vaccinating the 11-year-old is going to be greater than the 25-year-old. But several cost-effectiveness studies, some performed by industry and some performed by independent sources, have indicated that the vaccine is cost-effective up to the age of 26.
Okay, and then I'll follow
up. Yeah, I may
up
have gotten lost in your questions.
No, you're doing great. I tend to sling them along. So my second question is, funny things happen after vaccines get released. So, you know, the CDC just changed a recommendation about, I think it's ProQuad. I don't never know. It's always hard for me to remember all the names of the vaccines and how it's to be used. But any funny things pop up with the HPV vaccine since it's been licensed and used?
You know, the
widely?
Only thing that's popped up has been a very small number of episodes of syncope reported after subjects received the vaccine. The vaccine's got a pretty potent adjuvant to it. There's pain associated with immunization, as there are with all vaccines. And there were rare cases of people having post-injection syncope. It's now recommended that the vaccine be administered to individuals in a supine position. I don't want to overemphasize that. It was a really uncommon phenomenon, but it was one that was reported within about 6 to 8 months after the vaccine was licensed. At this point, that's been the only thing that has really come up. There's a lot of attention that's been paid to it. Anytime you have a vaccine that you're recommending for an entire group of the population, you know, it's extraordinarily important to be sure that these very rare post-licensure adverse effects that couldn't have been seen in the, you know, tens of thousands of people pre-licensure don't, in fact, materialize. So far with HPV, that's not been the case.
Okay, so a question, just a general question about adolescent vaccination. So for me, the two stories about vaccines over the last decade has been the number of new ones. And then secondly, the very, very crowded adolescent schedule and clearly the need to repeat many vaccines during the adolescent years. I suspect this is going to come up in people's late 20s and 30s. Can you envision a time when people won't graduate from high school unless they have a complete adolescent vaccination record? Because in part, the early success or the success of childhood vaccines is in part because it's necessary at the time of entry to school. So I can envision that before you get your high school diploma, you're going to have to produce a vaccination record.
Interesting concept. Yeah. I haven't heard that one discussed. I mean, as you know, when in the year after the HPV vaccine was licensed, there was a lot of discussion about making it mandatory for school entry. It came up in the legislatures of 20, 30 states. There were executive decrees in some states, such as Texas, that it be made mandatory. At this point, that's only been enacted in one state, I believe, Virginia, and that's not yet gone into effect. And it was largely because, you know, once the dust settled, it was realized that, well, look, we typically haven't made vaccines that are not transmissible by respiratory routes, which this one is clearly not, mandatory for school-based immunization until we've had a reasonable track record of understanding how well the vaccine works. The question you raised earlier, what happens when you give it not to 10,000 but to 10 million people? And whether or not you've got infrastructure to give the vaccine. You ask about costs for chlamydia. Well, the cost for HPV vaccine is really steep, and fortunately we've got a federal program that helps us with that, but there are people who fall between the cracks. So I agree with the notion that it was premature to make this mandatory at this point in time, even though you're absolutely correct that this has been a huge mainstay of how we've been successful with vaccination programs. Making it mandatory before graduation, really interesting concept. I couldn't go further than that at this point in time.
All right. So my last question, because I've gotten asked this from an audience when I speak on vaccines a bit, and I'll start with a personal vignette. So I have two teenage boys. Whether they're sexually active or not is confidential information, and I don't know anyway, so I can't really tell you. But let's assume that I have my teenage boys are sexually active. Let's say a lot. I have no idea what a lot is. Why shouldn't they be screened for chlamydia?
Well, the answer is they may well benefit from that at the individual level. And we haven't said don't screen males for chlamydia. In fact, we've recently issued some guidelines to our STD program partners who are involved in doing public female screening programs that if they're able to provide adequate coverage for female chlamydia screening and they are working in venues such as corrections or STD clinics where high prevalences of male chlamydia have been documented, then it's a good idea to go ahead and do male screening as well. The reason we haven't come out and done it more broadly writ is, frankly, a cost-benefit approach. Chlamydia is not harmless in men. It leads to urethritis. It can lead to epididymitis. It can lead to other complications such as rare autoimmune arthritis, something called Reiter's syndrome. And it certainly leads to transmission to females. But the individual benefit of chlamydia is in men much harder to document. It's a much higher level of proof from a cost-benefit point of view. It is likely that male screening would contribute toward reduced chlamydia, female chlamydia prevalence in the population, but not as directly as female screening and as partner treatment. So we're actively working on models to try to help us answer the question of how we thread the needle most effectively in terms of recommendations about male chlamydia screening. But at the individual level, if someone has got the resources and is concerned about chlamydia, there's no question that this is a sexually transmitted infection. There are high prevalences of chlamydia in men as well as women. And if the prevalences are significantly high, it is cost-effective to do the screening.
Thanks. John, one final question, a very practical one. If you could get a primary care clinician to do one thing different today, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. Respecting my wife's a primary care physician, so I hear all the time about the many demands in the 12 minutes of time you've got to see a patient. I think the single piece of lowest-hanging fruit is chlamydia testing in sexually active women under the age of 26. I'd love to answer your question by saying embark on a brief conversation about sexual activity, about sexual risk reduction, about using condoms, about selecting partners carefully, about awareness of other infections such as genital herpes. And gosh, if there's time to go there, I would absolutely say go there. And of course, you can't really get to chlamydia testing unless you at least ascertain if the person's sexually active or not. But if I had to get people to monofocus on one opportunity that I think could have the biggest impact, it's chlamydia screening in young sexually active women.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, John. I'm amazed. I know it's your job, but wow, you know a lot about screening for sexually transmitted.
It is my
diseases.
Job, but it's fun to talk to people who are interested in it.
Well, thank you. And that's our discussion for this week. I want to thank Dr. John Douglas of the CDC for talking with us. And I want to thank Dr. Howard Bochner of Boston University and Journal Watch for proposing this topic.
Okay,
see you next time.
Thank you both.
Finally this week, if you like Brian Eno and computer games, and who doesn't? Well, some don't. Get over to Fora TV. That's FORA.TV. And watch a collaboration between Mr. Eno and Will Wright, the inventor of SimCity and Spore, rather immersive computer games. I thought you might enjoy it. If you'd like to comment on this week's podcast, call 617-440-4374. Links for all stories are available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where you will also find a collection of previous editions. Join us next week, won't you? Thank you for listening. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia.